This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to The Economist, offering authoritative insight and opinion on international news, politics, business, finance, science, and technology. Stay tuned for the go-to magazine for great minds around the globe, right here on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is a reading of The Economist, and I'm your reader, Mary Kiefer, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I will be reading from the September 13th through 19th issue, copyright year 2025, The Economist Newspaper Limited. And here is a description of the cover of the magazine this week. This week's cover of The Economist is an illustration of three men working next to what initially appears to be a furnace and them feeding the fire. Upon a closer look, the walls of the furnace are actually stacks of computer servers, wide and high, filling the page, their LED lights softly glowing. Data cables dangle loosely from the ceiling. In the foreground are two men in silhouette, backlit by the bright red and orange glow of a blasting furnace. Both are wearing worker uniforms. Each man, one on the left, the other on the right, both a push dollies full of cash to be fed into the furnace for fuel. Floating around them are loose dollar bills propelled by the swirling heat. In the background is a third man. His silhouette is hunched over a pile of scattered cash with a shovel in hand, feeding the cash into the white-hot opening to the furnace. In the middle of the page, in bold white text, it says, "The $3 trillion bet on AI." And here is the article on the $3 trillion bet on AI. Even if the technology achieves its potential, some people will lose their shirts. It already ranks among the biggest investment booms in modern history. This year, America's large tech firms will spend nearly $400 billion on the infrastructure needed to run artificial intelligence models. OpenAI and Anthropic, the world's leading model makers, are raising billions every few months. Their combined valuation is approaching $500 billion. Analysts reckon that by the end of 2028, the sums spent worldwide on data centers will exceed $3 trillion. The scale of these bets is so vast that it is worth asking what will happen at payback time. Even if the technology succeeds, plenty of people will lose their shirts. And if it doesn't, the economic and financial pain will be swift and severe. Investors always flock to promising technologies, but the AI rush is more extreme than many past booms. Boosters say that artificial general intelligence models that are better than the average human at most cognitive tasks could be only a few years away. The first firm to achieve it could reap unimaginable returns. Investors and innovators know they may not be backing the right model. But if they spend slowly and cautiously, they may as well not bother to spend at all. Consequently, a relentless investment race is underway, with big tech firms splurging on the computing power needed to build the biggest models. A growing cast of extra players, from property developers to electricity generators, has been drawn in. Oracle is the latest to join the party. Its value surged on September 10th after it published an ambitious forecast for its AI-related cloud business, briefly turning its boss, Larry Ellison, into the world's richest man. No matter what happens, many investors will lose money. In the rosiest scenario, AGI will arrive and usher in a new world of economic growth of perhaps 20% a year, as we wrote in July. Some shareholders would enjoy astronomical returns. Many others would face big losses. More mundane scenarios should also be considered, however. The technology may evolve in ways that investors do not expect. When alternating current eventually prevailed in America in the 19th century, for instance, direct current electricity firms were overshadowed and forced to consolidate. Today, investors reckon that the probable AI winners are those that can run the biggest models. But as we report this week, early adopters are turning to smaller language models, which could suggest that less computing capacity may be needed after all. Or the road to widespread adoption could be slower and bumpier than investors expect, given today's AI laggards a fighting chance. Niggles in the technology, the difficulty of quickly supplying electric power, or managerial inertia could mean that take-up is more gradually than first hoped. As they revise down their expectations for AI revenues, many investors and creditors could become less willing to countenance huge investments. The flow of capital could slow. Some startups struggling under the weight of losses could fold altogether. What would such an AI chill be like? For a start, a lot of today's spending could prove worthless. So after its 19th century railway mania, Britain was left with track, tunnels, and bridges. Much of this serves passengers today. Bits and bytes still whiz through the fiber optic networks built in the dot-com years. The AI boom may leave a less enduring legacy. Although the shells of data centers and new power capacity could find other uses, more than half the CapEx splurge has been on servers and specialized chips that become obsolete in a few years. The good news is that today's financial system could probably absorb the blow. Some technological busts have been brutal. After Britain's railway bubble burst in the 1860s, banks were left with big losses, leading to a credit crunch. So far, however, much of the investment in data centers has been bankrolled from the deep well of big tech profits. Although firms, including Meta, are turning to debt to help fund their latest investments, their lucrative businesses and robust balance sheets mean they are well positioned to finance a technological boom. Among the keenest to provide that credit are private market funds, which are typically funded by rich individuals and institutions rather than ordinary depositors. AI startups tend to be financed by well-capitalized venture and sovereign wealth funds that could withstand losses. However, trouble spots could still emerge. The more the investment boom spreads, the more financing structures could get riskier, and the more indebted firms could be drawn in. Power companies are desperate to increase their investments to supply AI with the electricity it needs. A heavily indebted utility could easily become overextended. America's economy, too, would suffer a nasty shock. By one estimate, the AI boom has contributed 40% of its GDP growth over the past year, a staggering figure for a sector that accounts for just a few percent of total output. If investment projects are scaled back or ditched altogether, that will translate into economic pain as fewer data centers are built and fewer workers are employed to build them. To make matters worse, falls in the stock market could cause asset owners to cut back on their spending. Because the valuations of AI-related companies have rocketed, portfolios today are dominated by a handful of tech firms, and households are more exposed to stocks than they were in 2000. If prices fall, their confidence and spending could take a knock. The poorest would be spared because they tend to hold few stocks. But it is the rich who have fueled consumption in America over the past year. Robbed of its sources of strength, the economy would weaken as tariffs and high interest rates take a toll. The bigger the boom gets, the bigger the knock-on consequences of an AI chill could be. If the technology ends up fulfilling the extravagant promises that have been made for it, a new chapter of history will open. However, the story of its frenzied pursuit will make the textbooks, too. Beyond debate, the Republican activist Charlie Kirk challenged liberals until the day he was murdered. Charlie Kirk always contended that it was better to challenge bad ideas as he saw them than to swallow them. His professional life was devoted to his belief. At the age of 18, he dropped out of university to launch what would become America's most prominent conservative youth organization, Turning Point USA. On September 10th, Mr. Kirk was shot dead at a college campus in Utah, doing precisely what had brought him fame, purpose, and to MAGA supporters, great acclaim, debating liberals. Police have yet to arrest or name a suspect. That has changed since this article was written. On social media, President Donald Trump called Mr. Kirk legendary, adding that no one understood young Americans like he did. The murder follows a spate of politically motivated attacks in recent years, including, of course, two attempts on the president's life last year. Mr. Kirk accomplished much in his 31 years. In the early days of his organization, Republican donors whom he tapped for cash must have been taken aback. He was a gangly teenager who barely knew how to knot a necktie. Yet soon they were writing checks, charmed by his bulldog tenacity and fierce commitment to the cause of free markets and small government. They bet on the right horse. Mr. Kirk proved a formidable organizer. Today, Turning Point is a juggernaut. By 2023, the total revenue of Turning Point and its lobbying arm was $92.4 million, according to the New York Times. It has chapters at 850 colleges and hosts buzzy events featuring big names from the political right, Mr. Trump included. Mr. Kirk's influence also stemmed from his reputation as a tribune of the right, someone who was unafraid to defend conservatism against an imagined horde of blinkered liberals, libtards. Among TikTok users under 30 who voted for Mr. Trump in 2024, Mr. Kirk was the most trusted individual on the platform, a survey by TikTok found. He may have helped Mr. Trump retake the presidency. In last year's election, Kamala Harris's margin of victory among young voters was 12 points lower than Joe Biden's in 2020. A bigger swing than for any other age group. Mr. Trump reportedly credited Mr. Kirk for contributing to his improved showing among young voters. Mr. Kirk could easily have used his influence as a springboard to elected office. Certainly, he demonstrated an aptitude for shaping the Republican Party. Turning Point spent tens of millions of dollars on a Get Out the Vote campaign last year, and Mr. Kirk helped force out the chair of the Republican National Committee. After Mr. Trump was reelected, Mr. Kirk helped vet prospective appointees to the cabinet. He had become a power broker. Yet Mr. Kirk always maintained that he was not interested in running for office. He had something more consequential in mind. He believed that wokeism threatened to destroy the country. America would be saved not at the ballot box, but in the crucibles where culture is forged, like college campuses. A devout Christian, he wanted to carry on traveling from campus to campus, ripping the blinkers off liberal students' eyes, educating them about the evils of critical race theory and gender ideology, and urging them to start families and reclaim America for Jesus Christ. Mr. Kirk was bellicose and fiery on the stump, reflecting an age defined by partisan rancor, Americans' growing mistrust of and even hatred for their political opponents has been accompanied by a disturbing increase in assaults, near misses, and threats in recent years. These have included an arson attack targeting Josh Shapiro, the Democratic governor of Pennsylvania, a thwarted plot to kidnap Gretchen Whitmer, the Democratic governor of Michigan, and another to kill Brett Kavanaugh, a Supreme Court justice. In 2022, a man broke into the home of Nancy Pelosi, the then Speaker of the House of Representatives, and bludgeoned her husband with a hammer. In June, a state representative from Minnesota and her husband were murdered at home. Mr. Trump was lucky to survive being shot at an open-air campaign rally in Pennsylvania. Americans overwhelmingly reject political violence. Surveys suggest that less than a tenth endorse it, and that support is roughly the same on the left and right. But in a country awash with guns, it only takes one person to commit a heinous, attention-grabbing act. People who are looking for a purpose, who want to claim a historical mission, are moved by a public conversation that says, "You'll get attention, you'll be lauded if you hurt someone in public ways," notes Rachel Kleinfeld of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, a think tank. This applies equally to attacks against politicians, as to the murder of a healthcare executive last year. Two factors tend to influence support for political violence. When elites condemn it, citizens listen. People have a follow-the-leader instinct, says Rob Willer, a sociologist at Stanford University. A second factor is partisans' perception of what the other side thinks. Both Democrats and Republicans hold exaggerated ideas about how much their rivals tolerate violence, when in fact both sides mostly abhor it. This fuels misperceptions all around. Approval of political violence is not high in absolute terms, but it is still too high, says Mr. Willer. Fixing that comes through engagement. Mr. Kirk acknowledged this himself. Once a woman frostily asked him why he had come to her campus, he replied firmly, "When people stop talking, that's when you get violence." Buy and die. The president is fixated on America's Democratic cities. Going after places that welcome immigrants has become a favorite policy. Yet on September 4th, his administration arrested 475 foreign workers at a Hyundai electric car factory just outside Ella Belle, Georgia, a sleepy rural town deep in Republican country. Over 400 agents fanned out across the plant, ordering workers to present their papers or be carted off. Most of the people detained were South Korean nationals with the wrong kind of visas. Homeland Security declared it was the biggest worksite raid ever conducted in the department's two-decade history. At first glance, this makes sense. Donald Trump has made clear his goal of arresting and deporting as many illegal immigrants as possible. But he is also a president who wants to bring back manufacturing and entice foreign companies to invest in big projects on American soil. In Georgia, Hyundai was doing just that. More than a decade ago, the state of Georgia, the city of Savannah, and four surrounding counties teamed up to woo a big firm to breathe life back into agricultural counties near the coast that did not have enough jobs to keep high school graduates from leaving. Brian Kemp, the governor, traveled to South Korea to negotiate a deal and eventually secured a $12.6 $1.6 billion investment from Hyundai for a plant that promised 8,500 new jobs. The local economic development group worked tirelessly to make the rural region attractive to Korean executives. It helped rezone land to allow for more single and multifamily homes and encouraged voters in a referendum to endorse the construction of more schools. Since the project began in 2022, state and local governments have spent over $350 million to improve the roads. They also made the area's ports deeper and wider to accommodate ships bringing parts in and cars out. The project has been a smashing success. The factory celebrated its grand opening in March. Cars and T-shirts that day were decorated with Made in Georgia stickers. Although the big bosses are foreigners, the suppliers are mostly locals. Within an hour's drive of the plant, 20 companies that sell materials or component parts to Hyundai have popped up. Locally sourced products will make up more than 90% of the finished vehicles. The project is bringing more economic benefit to Georgia than the Atlanta Olympics did, says Tripp Tollison, the head of the Savannah Economic Development Authority. Where there were Dollar Generals and barbecue joints, there are now Korean grocers and high-end, high-pot restaurants. The raid puts Mr. Kemp, not Mr. Trump's favorite Republican, in an awkward position. The governor sees the factory as the biggest economic achievement, defending it even when members of his party criticized him for backing Joe Biden's green energy agenda. Now Mr. Kemp is mostly staying quiet, perhaps partly because the state clearly played a role in the raid. Georgia troopers blocked off roads before the feds went in, and Georgia Department of Corrections buses took the foreigners away. Mr. Tollison is confident that the immediate raid will not put the Hyundai deal in jeopardy. It could, however, make other companies more skittish. Cho Hyung, South Korea's foreign minister, flew to Washington on September 8th, returning just weeks after his president negotiated a 15% tariff cap with Mr. Trump. South Korea wants more legal visa options for Korean workers who have specialized skills. Those working at the Hyundai factory illegally were subcontractors flown over to install and inspect line equipment. Korean firms have long complained about lengthy visa waits, which delay construction. The Savannah Economic Development Team is working to set up advanced manufacturing programs at local colleges. They are even teaching the basics in primary school. One day, perhaps, Ella Bell will have enough skilled workers to do all the jobs that need doing. But that will do nothing for the region's and the country's car-making ambitions now. This week's obituary is for Giorgio Armani, the Italian master of elegance who died on September 4th at age 91. Those clear blue eyes noticed everything. In a second, in a restaurant, how the tablecloths were wrong. How a colleague's tie, 1.5 centimeters too long, spoiled the balance of his outfit. And how much of the angle of a woman's glove was too much to show. That was not a matter of inches, but of millimeters. The last say on everything had to be his. On the lanterns outside his headquarters in Milan, the makeup on each of his models, the weight of branch of office writing paper. Though he made no rule about it, at work he was Giorgio to no one. He might be in his favorite navy T-shirt, loosely pleated blue shorts and brown loafers, but he was Signor Armani, the arbiter of every detail of his life. So when faced with that classic of English tailoring, a man's suit, he had to change it. As it was, it punished the beautiful male body, squashing it into a box. What he demanded of a suit was freedom to move, to kneel before a mannequin or a model with a mouthful of pins to dress them, to reach across a table to grab samples. So he took the stiffness out, replacing heavy wool with crepe and choosing softer colors, beige, sand, light green. He dismissed shoulder pads and snipped away the lining. The suit drooped then, looking almost louche, suggesting the body without constraining it. He lengthened the jacket, enlarged the lapels, lowered the buttons, and there stood Armani Man. He changed the way women looked, too. His suits gave a fluid confidence without the rigidity of tight trousers and skirts. And he hid bad legs. He sympathized because when he appraised his own body, the cute little nose, the too big face, it was his short calf muscles that most displeased him. These basic suit ideas came to him in the late 70s, and having had them, he barely changed. He also loved to put women in flowing, simple evening gowns, tastefully beaded and in the colors of faded flowers. These two stayed. When designs were this good, when colors were this natural, and the whole look breathed elegance, not extravagance, why change after fleeting trends? He was not the first Italian tailor to redesign English suits, but he was the first runaway success at it. His company, founded in 1975, chalked up $14,000 in sale in its first year. A decade later, it made $100 million. By 2024, it was worth $9.3 billion to $11.7 billion and had branched into sportswear, furnishings, hotels, clubs, chocolates, and floristry. It was possible if clients had enough money to live an Armani lifestyle in an Armani world where all was natural sophistication, harmony, and ease. The big four French luxury houses ached to acquire him, but he ignored them. Independence was his byword. Giorgio Armani, S.P.A., was the child he had created with his life partner, Sergio Galliotti, after Sergio persuaded him to sell his blue Volkswagen Beetle to raise capital. He had done the designing, Sergio had done the books, a perfect arrangement. After Sergio's death from AIDS in 1985, the sole shareholder was himself. As a firm believer in astrology, he was a Cancer in every way. Creative, hypersensitive, introverted, and like a crab gathering everything to himself. He was Giorgio Armani, and he was not for sale. One key to his success was simplicity. His lines were loose, comfortable, and unfussy, and his more down-market range, Emporio Armani, was relatively cheap. But the chief secret of his stellar rise was cinema. As he grew up in northern Italy, it was the best of entertainments, endlessly inspiring him. He would have liked to be a film director, and in a way he was. To him, life was cinema, and his clothes were the costumes. So when in 1980 his style flew to fame on the back of Richard Gere in American Gigolo, it was a heady moment, and one that lasted. Stars on and off the red carpet took up his look by the limousine load. Diane Keaton, Tom Cruise, Sean Connery, Julia Roberts, Tina Turner, Kevin Costner, his hero, Martin Scorsese, and on and on. In 1983, he set up an office in Los Angeles. Sometimes he gave his clothes away. No Stylista had ever courted Hollywood so well. Yet star endorsements did not go to his head. He was shy and admitted that he got into fashion almost by accident. There had been no sudden spark, no sacred muse. He toyed with being a doctor, then served in the army before wandering off to dress windows. From then, fashion slowly stole his life away. By 1964, he was designing menswear line for Nino Cerruti. After that, he set up with Sergio, and other close friends were few. Evenings in his heyday often found him, whether in his casa in Milan, his penthouse on Central Park West, his island villa in Pantelleria, or any other of the houses he collected, settling with his cats, which he also collected, and turning on the TV just to hear another voice. His absolutist ways hid a lingering insecurity about his role in the serious business, the public service of fashion. That was also why he worked as he did, morning and night, getting everything as perfect as possible. This was the life he had chosen for himself, wrapped tight in sartorial chains. When he woke in the mornings and leapt out of bed, where he slept in a white T-shirt, he sometimes asked himself, "My God, why don't you stay in bed? Relax, make yourself a nice breakfast." That was impossible. He had ideas to sketch out, fabric to look at, the next show to plan. He had his and Sergio's child to look after. He also had to think of the future. That was hard. Though all films had endings, he could not imagine his company without him. It was not just a fashion house and a label. Giorgio Armani, S.P.A., was himself. The best he could do was to hope it would stay in the family, in the care of his right-hand man, his two nieces, and his nephew, an organic succession with no rupture. But who would really ensure the correct buttons on the jackets, hold the fort against violent colors, insist on the size of his blue glass flower cubes, achieve the perfect lighting for his shows? Unless he could make himself immortal, he feared no one could. The Fastest Kid on Earth. A teenage athlete makes his much-awaited international debut. Armand Mondo Duplantis, a Swedish pole vaulter, has broken the world record three times this year, reaching 6.29 meters. In July, Beatrice Chabay, a Kenyan athlete, became the fastest woman to ever run 5 kilometers. She did so in 13 minutes and 58 seconds. Noah Lyles, the defending Olympic 100-meter champion, is running into form. These stars will chase more records and glory at the World Athletics Championships, which begin on September 13th in Tokyo. But all eyes will be on a 17-year-old wunderkind called Gout Gout. The Australian sprinter is making his senior competitive debut in Tokyo. Mr. Gout is already familiar to athletics aficionados who have been stunned by videos of his races in local and regional tournaments. Last year, Mr. Gout covered 200 meters in just 20.04 seconds, making him the fastest 16-year-old in history and the fastest Australian over that distance. He broke a national record that stood for 56 years. In July this year, he bettered that benchmark again, bringing his time down to 20.02 seconds. All sporting prodigies burst onto the scene, but few have done so with such velocity. Mr. Gout combines speed with a distinctive upright running style. The teenager seems to leap rather than sprint across the track. He has an unusually long and strong Achilles tendon, his team says, which gives him the elasticity to stride over meters. You see him run and you just know there's something special, asserts James Templeton, Mr. Gout's manager. How special exactly? Mr. Gout is already being compared to Usain Bolt, the winner of 8 Olympic gold medals and the holder of world records in both the 100 and 200 meters. The Jamaican star, who retired in 2017, has said that Mr. Gout looks like a young me. Judging from the numbers, though, Mr. Gout is already ahead. At 16, Mr. Bolt's fastest time over 200 meters was a tenth of a second slower than Mr. Gout's. Mr. Gout's entourage is keen to temper expectations. The athlete continues to balance school and training, which is partly why he will skip the 100-meter race and run only the 200 meters at the World Championships. Interviews with the media have been carefully managed. The Economist was denied one. The goal in Tokyo is to make the final, but also to have fun, says Mr. Templeton. The real target in the Olympic Games is in Los Angeles in 2028. 4 years after that, an even more tantalizing prospect awaits. The Olympics in Brisbane, Mr. Gout's hometown. He will be 24 then, close to the age when sprinters reach their peak, and around the same age that Mr. Bolt was when he set his records. Those may be long-term goals, but the pressure and scrutiny have already begun. Adidas, a sportswear firm, has swooped in to sign Mr. Gout on a multi-million dollar deal. More than 10,000 people flocked to a small meet in Melbourne in March to watch him run a 200-meter race. It was the biggest crowd for a one-day event in more than 20 years. So far, Mr. Gout has shrugged off the attention. He still lives at home, where he shares a room with his brother and drives a Hyundai i30 rather than a flashy sports car. Mr. Gout's success has brought out the worst in some of his compatriots. In Australia, as elsewhere, immigration is a contentious subject. In August, Bob Catter, a politician also from Queensland, went viral for threatening to punch a journalist who brought up Mr. Carter's own Lebanese heritage. Mr. Gout's parents migrated from South Sudan to Brisbane in 2005, and the athlete was born 2 years later. Mr. Gout has received racist comments online. Some have erroneously suggested he is not really Australian. Yet to most sports-mad Aussies, he is already a hero. Mr. Gout speaks with an undeniable Queensland twang and has displayed perhaps the most Australian trait of all. Winning. His arrival on the global stage is good for athletics, too. The sport is struggling for relevance and attention outside the Olympics. To fix that, investors have been pouring money into new events with glitzy formats. A new star will surely boost those efforts. Few things invigorate a sport and excite fans as much as the breakout of a young marvel. Mr. Gout, like Mr. Bolt before him, may end up running the show. The dangers of nitazenes. A worrying new class of synthetic opioid is spreading around the world. On a morning in November 2023, Eamon Keenan, a psychiatrist who runs addiction services at Ireland's state-funded health care provider, received a worrying phone call. "People in homeless accommodation and hospitals are collapsing," he recalls being told. It was the start of a bleak few weeks. In Dublin and Cork, the country's biggest cities, 77 people would end up overdosing. The initial suspect was dodgy heroin, but laboratory analysis revealed a dangerous new class of drugs. Nitazenes. Since then, these have been detected everywhere from Freetown in Sierra Leone to Sydney in Australia. Nitazenes are opioids, a family of chemicals that includes morphine and heroin, as well as the much stronger fentanyl, which causes tens of thousands of deaths in America every year. Although measures of their potency vary, scientists estimate that nitazenes can be hundreds of times stronger than heroin, with some thought to be dozens of times stronger than fentanyl. But whereas heroin and fentanyl have long histories as medical analgesics and have therefore been extensively studied, hardly any research exists on nitazenes. With nitazene use rising around the world, and in particular in Australia and Europe, scientists are scrambling to gather data on how dangerous these new drugs are and who is at risk. The emerging picture is grim. Like fentanyl, nitazenes are molecules that do not occur in nature and must be fully synthesized from precursor chemicals in laboratories, all derived from a chemical structure called 2-benzylbenzimidazole, a small set of connected rings made up of atoms of carbon, hydrogen, and nitrogen. The first nitazenes were made in the 1950s as potential painkillers by researchers at Chemische Industrie Basel, an erstwhile Swiss company, but problems with these chemicals soon became apparent. Their therapeutic window, pharmacology speak for the dosage range that has the desired effect without unacceptable levels of side effects, was very narrow, raising the risk of accidental overdose. For instance, the Swiss chemists reported that whereas 200 milligrams of morphine per kilogram of body weight was enough to kill half of a test population of mice, the most potent original nitazene required only a 1 milligram kilogram to achieve the same effect. The number for heroin is somewhere in between. Nitazenes were consequently never approved for medical or veterinary use and soon faded into oblivion. In 2019, however, toxicologists conducted routine surveillance of the European drug market, turned up one nitazene, isotonitazene, being sold directly to users on a dark corner of the internet. Since then, isotonitazene, as well as some of its chemical cousins, have been found in America, Australia, Brazil, Canada, and most of Europe, as well as in countries across West Africa. Data on deaths are scarce because detection is not yet routine, but Britain's National Crime Agency believes at least 333 deaths in Britain in 2024 were linked to nitazenes. The spread of the drug shows no sign of stopping, according to the UN. More countries and regions report finding new nitazenes each year than report new versions of fentanyl. Many scientists study nitazenes believe the explosion in recent years is a supply-side reaction to increased restrictions on other drugs. In the mid-2010s, America boosted its attempts to crack down on new fentanyl analogs and their precursors, and persuaded other countries to do the same. China, which is home to producers and exporters of both fentanyl and nitrazenes, banned all analogs of fentanyl in early 2019, causing domestic production to plummet. In 2021, the Taliban seized control of Afghanistan, then the world's top producer of opium. It has since fallen behind Myanmar and outlawed the drug's production. As opium is needed to make heroin, illicit drug producers in Europe are thought to have turned to nitazenes amid fears of an imminent drop in supply. Whatever the reason, their appearance is bad news. Once nitazenes get into the brain, they bind to gateways on the surface of neurons known as mu receptors. When activated, these can suppress the body's pain signals. Nitazenes are more effective at activating these receptors than heroin, and in some cases, fentanyl. This means a smaller dose is needed to induce the strong analgesia and euphoria many users crave. But activation of the mu receptors can also lead to slowed breathing and, in the case of overdoses, cardiac arrest. Another worrying feature of nitazenes is the compounds they degrade into once inside the body, known as metabolites. Martha Van de Put, a toxicologist at the University of Ghent, published a study in ACS Chemical Neuroscience in 2021 showing that isotonitazene breaks down into another yet more potent nitazene. In other words, as the original drug disappears, a stronger one, although in a lower concentration, takes over, potentially prolonging the effects. This seems to set at least some nitazenes apart from heroin and fentanyl. That, in turn, has big implications for how first responders and doctors should treat an overdose. The normal procedure is to give a standard dose of naloxone, an emergency antidote that works by kicking opioids off the mu receptors and restoring normal breathing. But if nitazenes degrade into powerful metabolites that persist even after the original drug has gone, more naloxone may be needed than for a heroin overdose. This is a drug that challenges how we have treated these overdoses for the past 50 years, says Arne Christian Skullberg, an anesthetist with the Air Ambulance Department at Oslo University Hospital, and part of the team that developed the naloxone nasal spray sold in Britain. The potency of nitazenes make them attractive to smugglers because the same number of customers can be served with smaller amounts, which are easier and cheaper to distribute for the same price. But it also puts users at higher risk of overdosing, especially if they are taking it unknowingly. The batch found in Ireland in 2023, for example, although sold as Chinese heroin, contained nitazene, but no heroin, which led some users to inadvertently take too much. Nitazenes have also been found in tablets advertised as oxycodone, another opioid. In 2024, pills sold as MDMA, also known as ecstasy, during a music festival in Sydney, caused several hospital admissions. They were later found to contain nitazenes and no MDMA. Even tiny amounts of nitazene present in drugs such as cocaine and ecstasy, easily done if they are produced in the same lab, could endanger people with no built-up tolerance to opioids. Such cases have been reported. Ordering a pill online to check it out, taking it in their room, and being found dead by their parents. All this has prompted governments around the world to ban individual nitazenes. The ease with which their chemicals structure can be manipulated, however, means drug producers simply need to tweak a few lab procedures to create an entirely new product of similar potency, not subject to the ban. As a result, the authorities have changed their tactics. In January, the British government used a generic definition of nitazenes as compounds derived from the core structure of 2-benzylbenzimidazole to categorize all nitazenes as Class A drugs, the most severe criminal classification, in the hope of capturing and banning future variations. China implemented a nitazene ban using a similar generic definition in June. But even if the bans have the desired effect on nitazenes, they will not prevent new synthetic opioids from springing up and replacing them further down the line. That prospect worries researchers like Dr. Van de Put. We really don't know what's going to be next. And here are some business shorts for this week. The Murdoch family reached a settlement on who will head Robert Murdoch's media empire when he dies, bringing an end to the decades-long succession battle. Lachlan Murdoch, Mr. Murdoch's oldest son, emerged as the winner. He will take a controlling stake in Fox, which covers television and broadcast news, and News Corp, which publishes the Wall Street Journal and New York Post, and in Britain, The Sun and The Times, when his father, who is 94, passes away. Lachlan already runs the companies, but formally handing him the reins fulfills the elder Murdoch's wish that they continue to promote a conservative voice. What AI bubble? Oracle stock jumped by a third in value thanks to an astonishing quarter in which its expected revenue from future contracts for cloud services rose by 359% year on year. It also emerged that Oracle will supply OpenAI with data center capacity in a $300 billion contract. Larry Ellison, Oracle's founder, has seen his net worth grow by $191 billion this year to $383 billion. He is now vying with Elon Musk for the title of world's richest man. Anthropic's recent $1.5 billion settlement with a group of authors in a copyright lawsuit was roundly criticized by the judge overseeing the case. The suit alleges that the AI startup downloaded books from pirated websites to train its models. The judge called another hearing for September 25th to see if I can hold my nose and approve the agreement. The European Commission fined Google $3.5 billion for favoring its own display advertising technology to the detriment of its rivals. Google has 60 days to tell the Commission how it will remedy the situation or else face the possibility of being ordered to sell part of its ad business. Google said the fine was unjustified and that it would appeal against it. China's exports grew by 4.4% in August year-on-year, the slowest pace by that measure since February. The value of goods sent to America plunged by 33%, but exports to Southeast Asia were up by 22.5% and to the EU by 10%. Meanwhile, China fell back into deflation in August as the consumer price index dropped by 0.4% year on year. America's Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that 911,000 fewer jobs had been created in the 12 months ending March than had been thought. The revision is based on new census data and updated information from businesses. The head of the BLS was recently sacked by Donald Trump after a big downward correction to payroll members for May and June. The president had claimed those figures were rigged. Meanwhile, data for August suggested that only 22,000 jobs were created that month. A federal judge decided that Lisa Cook could continue to serve as governor of the Federal Reserve while she fights Mr. Trump's attempt to sack her. The judge ruled that because Ms. Cook's alleged transgressions in filling out a mortgage application occurred before she became governor, it did not meet the threshold of sufficient cause that the president had used to justify her firing. The decision means that Ms. Cook will get to vote on interest rates at the Fed's meeting on September 17th. Anglo American announced that it will merge with Teck Resources, a Canadian mining company, to become a giant in the production of copper. Mining companies have tried to consolidate in recent years, though few have succeeded. Anglo fought off a bid from BHP last year, and Teck rejected an offer from Glencore in 2023. Anglo Teck will have its headquarters in Vancouver, but will keep its primary share listing in London, with secondary listings in Johannesburg, Toronto, and New York. That's all the time we have for today. This has been Mary Kiefer with a reading of The Economist. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.